I'm a professional musician besides being a, whatever I am, archaeologist. I'm still getting used to saying the word. Actually, I'm still getting used to the idea of having to speak at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's, for most of you, it's the middle of the morning. For me, it's still the end of the night. As I said, I'm a musician. It reminds me of a story that Shalyapin was awakened, Pharaoh Shalyapin was wakened up one morning at about 11 o'clock, and he said, "You missed it." Somebody called him and said, "You better get down here, you missed the rehearsal. You have to sing." He said, Not only can't I sing, I can't even spit. At 11. Anyway, so I want to thank Ars and for having me, asking me to speak this morning, and it's a really, I think I do have a very interesting story to tell, and I hope I can interest you in it. It's a story that takes us back many years, and I'm not a professional archaeologist. I'm a record collector, and someone who I've been collecting since I was 5 years old, and I fell into this profession of sound restoration quite by accident. I was in college, and I wanted to be able to play the 78s that I own on the radio, and I wanted to figure out a way to make them sound listenable, and somehow manage that to some extent at least, and that's what got me started. And it was because in the 70s when I was doing this, there weren't a lot of available recordings of reissues of old performances, and so that I sort of fell into it by accident. But during the few times that I have been fortunate enough to stumble upon an interesting discovery, such as the stereo recordings at Bell Labs, it's been an unbelievable pleasure and something that has really sustained me throughout my life. And this recent discovery, which I did not make, but I've been involved with, has been another great experience for me. Now, I want to just explain that I'm not putting up any visuals this morning, and it's not because I'm blind, but I would be a little afraid of having the wrong one go up and you sitting there laughing at me because I don't know what's on the screen. But that's not really the reason. The reason is I really want you to take a trip with me, and I want you to just let your eyes relax and just use your ears for the next half hour. I'll be playing a few tidbits of music, and I'll be speaking about my experiences, and I just want you to do, as they say on the airplanes, sit back and relax and enjoy the flight. It'll be an interesting one. I'd like you to take, yesterday's Tim Brooks began his talk yesterday by saying, imagine a world where there was no, where material prior to 1940 was not under any copyright restriction. Well, I would like you to imagine a different world, but I would like you to imagine a world where there was no phonograph. Or imagine a world where the phonograph had just been invented and was only known about through newspaper articles and publicity, but a world where no one owned phonographs yet. This would have been the late 1880s, and Edison was still perfecting the phonograph. And imagine this world, no boomboxes, no radios, no phonographs, a few telephones. The only noise you would hear are horses clopping in the streets, and you might hear some train whistles or some factory whistles, and that sort of thing. That's about the only amplification, the amplified sound you might hear. And it's a quieter world. And I would like to quote from a fantastic letter that's just come to light. My longtime friend Greg Benko bought a letter not too long ago from Hans von Bülow, the great pianist and conductor who was in the midst of his final U.S. tour in 1889. And he wrote a letter to a friend, and the letter's in French, but I'm reading from a translation made by Carl Tate of this letter. And this will set the scene, I think. He's talking about the tour itself and how one day is like another. And he says,
The days that follow each other don't always resemble each other. The one that unrolled recently wasn't worth much. I was, as a result of unforeseen circumstances, much more nervous than was necessary for me. I played in a very mediocre way. The principal reason for my debility was the magician Edison. He had sent his aide-de-camp, Mr. Vongerman, a charming man as well as a compatriot, with his new graphophone or phonograph simply for the purpose of phonographing my concert. Fear seized me. That is to say, the fear of failing at my business. I played the last nocturne of Chopin. 5 minutes later, this hard little wax cylinder with incisions so subtle that one cannot follow them with the naked eye, it was replayed to me, and so clearly and faithfully that one might cry out with stupefaction, "It is to die for." What an unparalleled revolution for the world of sounds. Now, isn't that some letter? Imagine that. I mean, just reading it, my hair is standing on end. I mean, imagine the nervousness of having to record for the first time when it was only thought of and known about by a few people. I mean, I'm nervous just sitting up here talking to you. And by the way, I've made cylinder recordings, and it's very nerve-wracking. My friend Peter Dilge in Long Island is an expert cylinder recordist. And I had won an award from the Classic Record Collector magazine in London, and I couldn't be there for the dinner, and I thought I would send over a cylinder of greeting, which they played at the dinner, which was a big hit. And I recorded a cylinder. And I was, standing there in front of this horn, I was shaking like a leaf. I really was. My hands were shaking. I was so nervous. And I've been on the radio many, many times. I've spoken before people. I was so nervous. I couldn't believe it. But I was. And that's something about how it felt. Well, anyway, at about the same time, I want to mention something else. Yes, the next day, after this occurrence happened with Vongerman recording von Bülow's concert, he visited Edison's laboratory and also in the letter writes of the some of the cylinders that he heard at the lab. For example, the first movement of Schumann's Fourth Symphony, conducted by Theodore Thomas, and the great Wagnerian prima donna, Lili Lehmann, singing Brunhilde's Entrance from Die Walküre. Imagine that. And one of the things I want to stress today that I think we all have to have our eyes open and our ears open, and these cylinders may still exist somewhere. And preservation at this point is so important because these recordings are so apt to vanish right under our eyes. And if they don't vanish, they might deteriorate in 50 years. They're not permanent records, really. The wax deteriorates. There are plenty of examples of wax cylinders that played much better 50 years ago than they do now. These things have to be preserved, not only the artifact itself, but they have to be preserved in the sense that the sound must be gotten off them. And I can't stress this enough. The sound must be gotten off now. And even if it's not the best way to, even if we haven't found the best way to do it, and I know there are people who disagree with me about this, but I think it needs to be done. Not only do we need to do it before the artifacts themselves vanish or deteriorate, but it needs to be done because there is still a connection. People still care about this material. We don't know what people are going to feel about it in 50 or 100 years, and there are still people who remember people, who remember people, who knew the people that made these records. And that's the important connection. The man I'm going to talk about in a minute, Julius Block, Julius Block's granddaughter, is still alive and very vibrant. She's a prominent physician. And while she did not know her grandfather, her family told many, many tales and stories about Julius Block, And she has told them to me and passed it along. And that's why these things need to be preserved. Now, at about the same time that von Bülow was hearing a cylinder for the first time, there was a man named Julius Bloch, who was born in 1858. His father was a prominent businessman who did business in Russia and in America. And Bloch was born in South Africa, so technically he was a British subject, but he received his education, a good part of his education here in the States. And he continued in his father's company, and it was an extremely successful businessman. He introduced, among other things, he introduced the bicycle to Russia. He also introduced the escalator to Russia. And in Moscow, he had a very large shop that sold bicycles and typewriters and other sorts of things of that sort, newfangled devices. Well, he read about the phonograph, and he, on a trip to the States, he decided to visit Thomas Edison. And he made an appointment and visited Edison. And Edison at first was too busy to see him, and he ended up seeing one of Edison's assistants. But finally, the great man did spend some time with Bloch that day, showed him the phonograph, played him examples of cylinder recordings that Edison had made at the laboratory. And Bloch asked if he could take a phonograph to Russia with him, and Edison said, yes, certainly. And so Bloch took this phonograph back to Russia with him. He learned to make records in a very short time. Edison, one of Edison's assistants, gave him some rudimentary lessons in how to record. And he took the phonograph back with him and began to make cylinder recordings in Russia. He demonstrated the phonograph for Tsar Alexander III, and actually the Tsar purchased a phonograph from Edison. Bloch was also, I forgot to mention, Bloch was also an amateur musician, and a very good one. He was a good pianist. And he cultivated the friendship of all the great musicians in Russia, in Moscow and Petersburg at the time. He was very close friends with Tchaikovsky. He was friendly with Rimsky-Korsakov and other musicians that I will speak of soon. Bloch would put on these what he would call phonographic soirees, that he would invite musicians to come for the evening, and he would play cylinders that he had recorded for them, and he would also make recordings during these soirees. And he was very aware of the historical importance of what he was doing. He was keenly aware that the phonograph was far more than a toy, and it was far more than just a device to be used in business for dictating letters. He recognized, he was one of the first people to really recognize the importance of capturing voices and music from the era in which he lived. And he began to record cylinders in 1891. I have a few little examples to play you. Now, these are snapshots. As you know, cylinders usually they run for about 2 to 3 minutes in this time. These are brown wax cylinders, and he tended to record them at about 120 revolutions per minute, but that's only a vague speed idea, because some of the cylinders turned out to be recorded at 70 or 80 revolutions and some a little faster than 120. But anyway, I'd like to play you one very interesting one. This is a bit of the Mozart Fantasy in C minor. This was recorded by a very important composer and an important pianist of the time, whose name was Taneyev. He was Scriabin's teacher, Rachmaninoff's teacher. He was a prominent teacher at the Moscow Conservatory. So let's hear a little bit. I'm just going to play a little bit, but of this, Fantasy in C minor of Mozart, recorded in 1891. It's a fantastic time capsule because, well, Mozart had only been dead. Mozart had been dead 100 years, okay, at that point. Mozart, since that time, 118 years have passed. So I think it's a very interesting point to make that this might be, though not necessarily, but might be a Rosetta Stone for, certainly it is a Rosetta Stone for play, for how Mozart was played at that time, but it might actually be closer to Mozart's actual playing than we are now. That's a matter for musicologists and academics to debate, and they will enjoy that sort of thing because that's what they like to do. And I'm hoping, actually, that one of the things that I really hope is that this issue that I've done, that we've done on Marston, I really hope that this will spawn some serious discussion about performance practice, because these musicians most of the musicians that Bloch recorded didn't end up making commercial records. As all of you know, classical music really didn't get rolling. I shouldn't say rolling, that's a bad word to use. Spinning. until about, you know, seriously, there aren't very, I mean, Bettini made cylinders of important singers in 1897 to 99 and so on. Very few of those exist. We only know of a handful of Bettini cylinders, and of course we would love to find a big cache of those someday, and I think we have to keep our eyes open for that. As a matter of fact, I received a letter recently from someone in Russia, a collector who has several Bettini cylinders that have never surfaced before, and he sent me some fairly crude transfers of them, but they're worth having. And yes, I would love to have better transfers. But if I had a choice between the crude transfer that he sent and no transfer, I'd rather have the crude one any day of the week. But anyway, we didn't really get any important classical musicians recording until the beginning of the 20th century. And so some of these Bloch cylinders recorded in Moscow and St. Petersburg predate commercial recording of classical musicians by almost 10 years. And that's really important because it extends our timeline backward. Well, let me play you another little bit of history. And this is a piece by Anton Arensky, who you all probably know, the name at least. And he didn't make any records. And there's quite a bit of Arensky on this in this Bloch collection. The Bloch collection, because Arensky was a close friend of Bloch, and obviously enjoyed recording. And would come over and make some of these cylinders. And this is a recording of a little bit of the second movement of the famous Arensky Trio in D minor. And this was recorded in 1894, the same year that it was written, just around the time of the premiere. And the violinist is a famous soloist called Jan Hirmeli. And the cellist is Anatoly Brandjukov. And a very prominent cellist in Russia. Both taught at the Moscow Conservatory, and both had major careers as soloists. Let's hear a little bit of the second movement of the trio in D minor. Oh, sorry about that. Can we go to the next track? Sorry, I put an extra track on there. Thank you. it's really an amazing recording, I think. And it's the first time any chamber music had actually been put on the tracks. And the ability that Blanc managed to get the violin, the piano, and the cello balanced so beautifully is really quite remarkable, I think, considering he had one horn that he was using. Anyway, what happened was that Blanc would play these cylinders and would make recordings, and he kept a lovely autograph album. And this autograph album is preserved even today. We're so fortunate to have it. It's a beautiful, it's on gorgeous paper with a lovely border in which people like Rimsky-Korsakov, Tchaikovsky, Anton Rubinstein, and others inscribed testimonials to the phonograph, to Blanc, to Edison, and to the phonograph. And this fantastic autograph book is preserved at the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive. I urge any of you that are in New York that can get there to see it. I'm hoping that soon it will be available. At least some of the pages will be online available. And in the Marston CD booklet, we have reproduced some of the more interesting autograph pages from the book. And I'd like to thank Sarah Velez from the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archive for permitting us to reprint these pages and being so helpful to us. One of the most interesting quotations or testimonials in this autograph album was from Leo Tolstoy. And it's so beautifully written. And he wrote it in English, by the way, not in Russian, not in French, but he wrote this testimonial in English. And I'd like to read this to you because I find it quite moving. Quote, "The greatest power of the world is thought. And the more thought, the more forms there are of expressing thought, the more this power manifests itself. The invention of printing made an epoch in the history of humanity. Another will be made by the telephone and especially the phonograph, which is the most efficacious and striking form of fixing and immortalizing not only the words, but also the expression of the voice which pronounces them." And I think that says a lot, and it's beautifully written. And that is in this autograph album. Blanc continued to make cylinders, and he actually left Russia, moved to Berlin in 1899, had a period of time when he didn't make any cylinders, but began to record again in 1911, and recorded for a time in Berlin. In a matter of fact, made recordings of the young Heifetz, the 11-year-old Yasha Heifetz. These recordings actually are not as good. They don't sound as good as the 1890s ones. I think his machine was not in as good condition by 1911 as it was in 1891. After the First World War, he moved to Switzerland and continued to make a few more recordings. He died in 1934, and his collection was donated to the Phonogram Archiv at the Ethnologische Museum in Berlin. And during the war, it was moved from Berlin eastward I think two or three of the compositions. We're still missing one or two. It's interesting. Arensky recorded one cylinder, which was labeled by Blanc as an excerpt from his opera Raphael. Now we know that Arensky did make a piano transcription of sort of highlights from Raphael, and I invited a friend over to sit and sight read through that score with me, and nothing in that score is what is on this cylinder. So I can tell you that for sure. But we still don't know what the piece is. But I'm hoping we will figure it out. Somebody certainly will figure it out. Am I over time?
You got 5 minutes.
I've got 5 minutes. Okay. I'm always worried about this because this whole project excites me so much that I could talk for hours about it, and on any number of aspects of the project. But you know what? It's really in the music. And I think I've made my point about the importance of preservation. So let's hear one or two more little music clips. The next one is by a pianist who was a remarkable pianist of his day, whose name was Paul Pabst, P-A-B-S-T. He was a Liszt pupil, and a very important teacher at the Moscow Conservatory. He had a rather short life. He was born in 1854 and died in 1897 at the age of 43. I have no doubt he would have made records had he lived longer. And he is now famous for a transcription that he made of the, well, it's a paraphrase actually, of the waltz from Sleeping Beauty of Tchaikovsky. Now, he was a very close friend of Tchaikovsky, and several of Tchaikovsky's works were dedicated to Paul Pabst. And as a matter of fact, Shura Cherkassky has made a lovely recording of this paraphrase from the Sleeping Beauty. Well, Paul Pabst recorded part of this paraphrase, and it happens to be one of the best cylinder examples we have from the Bloch collection. Just listen to this piano sound from 1894. Maybe 95.
Так парафразу пьесы «Красавица» Чайковский Пабста. Помнил автор 12 февраля 1895 года. Москве.
I want to just mention also, it's not just pianists that Bloch recorded. He also made recordings of a number of very important vocalists, singers. Maria Klementova Morontseva, who was the first Tatiana in a student production of Evgeny Onegin of Tchaikovsky. It was given as a student production before it was actually premiered, and she was the original Tatiana. And she sings a Tchaikovsky song with Taneyev at the piano, and they were all friends of Tchaikovsky. I mean, it's just amazing, and this is just incredible. And, you know, I really am, my great hope is that something definitive, musicologically, will be written about these recordings in a publication like 19th Century Music or something scholarly. I mean, this is a very important discovery. And, you know, this is not about me. This is about Bloch. And this is about the great musicians who recorded for Bloch, who otherwise would not be immortalized. And I can't stress the fact enough that I urge you to go to our website and look at the booklet, read up on these people. It's a fascinating story. And I now will turn the program over to my good friend David Giovannoni. Thank you very much.